This is a Toronto Public Library broadcast.
Welcome to Live Mic, the best of TPL conversations. On October 17, 2018, Canada became the second country to legalize the consumption and possession of cannabis. How will this change Canada? How will our laws adapt to these new realities? These questions are answered in this Toronto Star discussion with Irene Gentle, editor of Toronto Star. She is joined by Trina Fraser, leading expert on cannabis law and legal advisor to the Cannabis Council of Canada. Mitchell Osak, leading cannabis thought leader who speaks and writes extensively on global trends, regulatory issues, and consumer behavior. And Dr. Melissa Snyder Adler, a board-certified addiction medicine physician specializing in addiction prevention and workplace substance use. Listen as these panelists unpack the diverse ways that changing marijuana laws will impact our day-to-day lives.
So it feels like we've been talking about legalizing cannabis for so long that it may never actually happen. So we're going to get straight into this. We just want to get that the purpose of tonight is to leave with as much information as possible what is actually going to change and not change after October 17th. So let's start with legal. There's a lot of legal questions on this. So Trina, on October 17th, what becomes legal and what is still illegal?
So we've had a medical cannabis framework in Canada for many years, since 2001, in fact. And so what we're seeing, though, on October 17th is that we are expanding, essentially, the scope of legal activities with cannabis to include recreational or non-medical, adult use, whatever terminology you want to use, beyond medical use. So there's the thing that makes it a little bit tricky and complicated is that it involves every level of government. There's a federal framework which sets some boundaries and deals with production, and then we've got a provincial layer and territorial layer which talks about distribution and sale and consumption, and then we also have municipalities getting involved with places for consumption and zoning for sites, and so it can actually get quite convoluted. But at its very highest, it essentially will become legal for adults to purchase up to 30 grams of cannabis at a time and to be able to legally consume that cannabis wherever you are legally allowed to do so, wherever you happen to be located, which varies from province to province and municipality from municipality. Depending on where you live, you may also be able to grow up to 4 plants per dwelling. So not in Quebec and Manitoba for the time being, but everywhere else in Canada. So the permissible product types are essentially just an extension of what's available in the medical market right now. So it's dried flower or bud, and then cannabis oil that has a very pretty restricted concentration of THC. So I think you've probably all heard in the media that, you know, edibles and concentrates will not come on board until sometime later. So, you know, the federal government just needed a little bit more time to make sure it was properly regulating those new product types, which haven't been part of the medical framework. But it's built into the Cannabis Act that those regulations must be in place by October 17th, 2019. So essentially 1 year of legalization. I wouldn't be surprised if we see those regulations coming on board sooner than that, though, I'd say maybe summer next year, because I think the federal government understands that to really tackle the illicit market that is part of the objective of legalization, those product types have to be included.
So you've touched on that the rules change depending on where you live. Since this is Toronto, let's talk a little bit about what's actually going to happen here. Where will you be allowed to legally smoke, for example? Would you be allowed to outside of a restaurant like you would if you were taking a cigarette break, just a certain amount away from the door? If you live in an apartment building or a condo unit, can you do it on your balcony? What's allowed and what's not here?
So I'll just ignore the medical context for a moment because the rules are a little bit different if you're using for medical purposes. But in Ontario, the Cannabis Act that was passed by the previous provincial government contains an absolute ban on public consumption of cannabis in any form. So essentially the only legal place to consume recreational cannabis will be within a private dwelling. And, you know, that's only if your landlord and your condo board or, you know, allow you to. In the medical context, it's a little bit different because it's treated more like tobacco, frankly, and the rules in the Smoke Free Ontario Act will apply to both tobacco and e-cigarettes and smoking and vaping cannabis. So, you know, just in not around schools and daycares and enclosed workplaces or public places, but generally speaking, you could, you know, walk down the street and consume your medical cannabis. So your balcony is part of your, is a private place. So yes, in your, within your house, within your home, on your property, on your balcony, again, subject to any condo issues or landlord issues, that's pretty much where you're restricted to for now. Knowing also that we're going to probably see a bill introduced in the next few weeks that's going to change the rules about how cannabis is sold and might change the rules about where it's consumed. We don't know.
So you mentioned that some condo buildings have proactively banned it. Do you believe that those will hold up? Like, are those legally sound? Would you anticipate maybe some human rights challenges to things like that? And actually just taking that even further, what lawsuits can you envision coming out of legalization period?
Oh, so many. The really ironic thing that, you know, is concerning to me is that in some respects, legalization is actually making things worse for medical cannabis users, because whereas the issue just may have never been addressed in certain contexts before, legalization is forcing long-term care facilities and retirement homes and condo boards and landlords to turn their minds to these issues and to create policies for them. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing in many cases is just kind of blanket policies that prohibit everything, including medical use, which, you know, in my opinion, is a violation of the Human Rights Code. And I do think we're going to see challenges to the Human Rights Tribunal with respect to a failure to accommodate medical cannabis use. But, you know, we're also going to see challenges to the home-growing bans in Manitoba and Quebec. We're going to probably see some challenges to the promotional restrictions in the Federal Act. We're going to see, you know, the fights with landlords, condo boards. There's going to be no end to, because even in the recreational context, there certainly are people who believe that their landlord or their condo board shouldn't be able to stop them from engaging in illegal activity within their own home. And so there's going to be some interesting issues come out of that for sure.
And what about driving? Do you think as a society, as a police force, as a legal system, are we prepared for drugged driving?
Apparently not. Nobody can agree on what impairment is or how to measure it or at what point you are impaired. And I think it's kind of a hot mess right now. We've got an approved device that nobody seems to want to pay for or use. And so, you know, I think looking at some of the U.S. states that have legalized, I don't know how much of an increase in impaired driving we'll actually see, but certainly it's a very like hot issue that law enforcement is being forced to deal with. And I have a problem with the bill that was Bill C-46 that was just recently passed and the amendments to the impaired driving laws. I, you know, feel it's swung the pendulum too far as infringing our, you know, privacy rights and, you know, in order to combat impaired driving. But there's no perfect answer. I don't profess to know what the exact right answer is. And the problem, of course, all stems from the fact that the relationship between THC and levels in your bloodstream and impairment aren't as direct and obvious and, you know, assured as between alcohol and you know, so an impairment. So that's the tricky thing is that, I'm not a medical expert, so I'll still steer clear of the actual measurement issues, but from a legal perspective, I'm concerned with the state of the laws right now, and I think we're going to definitely, I should have added that to my list of legal challenges. Those laws are going to be challenged too.
Well, thankfully, we actually do have a medical expert on our panel. So how about that level of THC?
So, I mean, you're absolutely right. With respect to impairment, alcohol and THC are totally two different things. So alcohol, you drink, we know that it gets in your bloodstream and it clears about one drink an hour approximately over time. It's linear, it's predictable, we know exactly what it is. It correlates from the breath test that we use to what's in your blood to what impairment is. THC is vastly, vastly different. You cannot compare it. And there are people, you know, with the 5 nanograms per mil cutoff that they're using in blood, there are people that absolutely will be impaired. But there are people that may have a cutoff of 5 who may not be impaired if you're doing true impairment testing. So when it comes to, and we can have a whole discussion on that whole dragger device, that the roadside one, but what I will say is that the police right now do have a way of testing impairment, and that is with the DRE, not with the blood test and not with the that. So that's a drug recognition expert. That's what they're doing right now. So there are some jurisdictions that are saying we're not going to go to the device right now. We're simply going to do what we've been doing, and that is doing a standard field sobriety test, which is the roadside one that you hear about, the walk in the straight line and pointing, you know, all of that. And then when, you know, we think that there's a concern, we're going to do the full, more detailed examination, and that's what we're going to use to tell impairment. So, you know, what it's going to look like, whether they're going to end up doing blood testing, they probably will. There will likely be charges. They will likely be challenged. I can almost guarantee they will be challenged. But, you know, what they have to do is look at what we call per se limits. And so what that means is this, is that when we started off with alcohol testing, we really picked a number out of the hat. And if you really look at all the data and where we're at and what the levels are and what the numbers are, they took that number because that, from a study perspective, was showing that most people at that level are impaired. And that's sort of what they're doing with the blood levels right now. But again, it's, you know, we're going to have to wait and see whether they stand up or they don't stand up, and what it looks like.
So just keeping on the medical theme for a minute, and the alcohol theme, actually. We know that alcohol and its effects on the body has been studied a lot, and the results often seem contradictory anyway when you hear about them. But is there a commensurate amount of study on marijuana and the body? Do we have a full sense of what marijuana actually does to the body, or are we coming in from behind on this?
Well, yes and no. You know, what we do know a lot. You know, it's been around for a long time. From a medical perspective, it's different than medications. So medications went through a whole Health Canada approval, which means that there needed to be very detailed number of studies. So we have lots of studies, but they're not all the best studies. And so we're kind of behind the eight ball on that one, for sure, with respect to medical and does it help, does it not help, what studies there are, what studies there are not, and really more so what there's not. When it comes to the effects on the brain, we do know, and we do have many studies that talk about the effects on the brain. The problem is that it looks different for each person. So whether you, and I don't even mean whether you're young or you're old or you're larger or smaller, it also is dependent on how much you've used in your lifetime, how often you use, how frequently you use, what your history of use is, the amount that you're using, the percentage that you're using, you know, so there's so many factors. With alcohol, it doesn't matter what your history of alcohol use is. You may not look the same as somebody who doesn't often drink, but from an impairment perspective, it's the same. With THC, it looks vastly different, but we know it affects the brain, it gets into the brain, it affects the receptors and the neurotransmitters, and we do know that there are impairments that are, you know, I mean, we can sort of list them all off, but again, it looks different for every person.
So there's been a lot of marketing in the last little while of cannabis for women, and kind of cannabis as the new rosé. It's the more healthy way to relax. So as a medical professional, how do you respond to that?
So I always say, I don't know that it's better than alcohol. Although, you know, I get the argument of, well, nobody ever dies from cannabis, but people do die from alcohol poisoning. True. But, you know, is it better? Is it worse? I don't know. It really depends on who you are. I mean, if you decide that you want to have a drink on a Saturday night and you're not going to drive, or you decide you're going to smoke a joint, vape, eat something or whatever, and you're not going to drive, you know, is there any difference? I don't know. It's not that I'm against it. People, you know, I go up and speak and people are like, you're just against cannabis. I'm not. It's your choice. You know, is it better? I don't know. It depends. It's different. You know, it's very hard to compare. One's better, one's not. There can be many issues with alcohol, but there can be issues, many issues with THC as well, especially if you are dosing too much, too quickly, especially with the edibles, which we'll, I guess, get into next year. There can be lots of issues with that. But it, you know, if you're doing it with some sense and some caution and in a safe way, is it any different? I'm not sure.
Mitchell, one of the reasons that the government was thinking about legalization in the first place is to eradicate or reduce the black market. Do you have any sense? What is your view on whether this is going to be effective in that?
When you look at the justification for legalizing adult use cannabis by the Liberal government and as well as a lot of pundits over the years. It was essentially around two things. It was around safety, and it was around eliminating or seriously degrading the illicit or the black market. So the question, as I understand it, Irene, is will existing legislation, both on a federal and provincial level, eradicate or seriously degrade the black market? And I'm here to tell you, in the short term, I think the answer will be absolutely not. For three fundamental reasons, in my humble opinion, and again, this is not personal experience, but it's based on a study of what's happened in other jurisdictions like Colorado, Nevada, Holland, California, where you have legalized recreational cannabis. And it's based on the research that's been done where you've started to legalize things like gambling that heretofore were not legal. Okay, so three things have to be satisfied to seriously degrade the black market, the illicit market. Number one is you need to have access. Age of majority adults who want to go and buy legal regulated cannabis need a place to go and buy it. In the short term, particularly in this province, but for most of Canada, you will not have true access like you would have if you picked up the phone and you called your buddy and he or she showed up with a knapsack within an hour with 12 strains of pot and spark up a duber for you to sample that pot. You will not have anything like that. Number two, you need a cannabis that's price competitive against the black market. So what we do know right now is that the price of legal cannabis, for some very good reasons, is going to be significantly higher than the illegal price of cannabis. And what we've found in some of these other jurisdictions is that the black market, the mafia, the Hells Angels, all those folks are rational economic players. And what do I mean by that? Is that to keep their market share, they have decided in many cases to drop their price. So they've made it even more appealing for people who used to go and buy on the black market to buy even more than they were in the past. Number three, which I'm hoping on October 18th we'll be able to fix, at least initially, is that the quality of the cannabis has to be as good, if not better, and the quality, pardon me, and safety of the cannabis has to be as good, if not better. I'm a little more optimistic around that, although we haven't seen any products on a shelf yet. But given those three things, and at least two of them won't be the case, at least for the first year or so, I'm not optimistic.
Let's talk about workplaces. So if we think of the whole of society, may or may not be ready. Are workplaces, this will be for you, Melissa, are workplaces prepared? And if they're not, what should they do to be prepared?
So I've spent the last year and a half, I think, really where all I've been doing is reading about and speaking about cannabis. I said the other night that I have so much cannabis in my head, and it's not from using it, that I could not read one more thing. But, you know, what I will say is this, is that from speaking to companies, there are some companies that are prepared, meaning that they have fit-for-duty policies, they have drug and alcohol policies, they've updated them, they've educated people on them, they've discussed it, they've taught people, and everyone kind of knows what they're going to do. I'd say those are the small percentage, the very small percentage. Even in safety-sensitive industries, it is shocking to me how many people today or even last year, forget about recreational cannabis, there are other drugs out there, right? We are in the midst of an opioid epidemic. People are using cocaine. People are using methamphetamine more so today than they were. So they may not even be prepared for that. And so what I urge people to do, if you have a business, no matter what the business is that you need to ensure that you have a policy. You need to ensure that people, dust it off and make sure that you update it based on new legal decisions, which I won't talk about. That's it. People are taught, and you really decide what you can and can't say and what you should and shouldn't do in the workplace to ensure that everybody's safe. You know, it's not just safety-sensitive industries, because we all know that you can't come to work impaired no matter what you do. It doesn't matter what job you have, you really aren't supposed to come to work impaired. So, but again, we don't have a great way of testing impairment for drugs, only alcohol. So that's...
So back to Mitchell. You sort of mentioned, that the consistency of product is something that one assumes will be here with legalization. So right now, if you buy it on the street, you don't necessarily know what degree of anything is in it, what exactly is in it, where exactly it came from. In theory, part of the theory of legalization is that you will have a better sense of that. So first of all, is that perception real? And if so, who's doing the monitoring?
Yes. That perception is real. Is as critical as I've been, and I've spoken about and written about how this whole cannabis drama and journey has been unfolding across the country, including our province, there has been some major, I would say, successes. One of them is the federal government's ability to regulate and set high standards around the production of high quality, and I'm not saying good cannabis, like that gets you super high and you enjoy it, but high quality cannabis that's safe for users. There's been a variety of recalls among some very large licensed producers, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I'm sure you've heard about a lot of them, because they have failed audits from Health Canada. And our federal government, I'm proud to say, is taking that responsibility very, very seriously. So in that sense, I'm very confident that the cannabis that all of you will consume on October 18th will be safe for you.
All of you, did you hear that? There's
will be absolutely safe for you. Having said that, there are additional sort of steps, and you know, if I can invoke Adam Smith, the famous economist and philosopher, there's such a thing called the invisible hand or the market. So we don't know, and no one really knows, because there's literally no data from the illicit black market, what will sell and what won't sell. Will Maui Wowie sell more than Nuclear Kush, sell more than Purple Hendrix? Like, you just don't know, and we don't even know what's in them. So there's going to be a certain amount of time, and it could last for years, where the product portfolios of these particular licensed producers get settled, and the industry starts organizing itself into segments, just like you have in cars and in fashion and cosmetics and detergents and so on. That's going to take a long time, but that's that market, the invisible hand, that will self-regulate to ensure not only is it safe, and thankfully the government's looking after that, but that we're smoking or eating or vaping really good cannabis. Because if we're doing that and we can buy it, then existing users will no longer go to the illegal market, but they'll go to a regulated and licensed producer. So that will take time, and as my colleagues here have said, you know, the rules are still in flux. But long-term, cannabis will be like any other consumer product, and it'll evolve that way. The question is how and when. I don't think anybody really knows, including the producers and including the government.
So going with Ontario, Ontario is a bit of an outlier in that it's starting with online shops only and then getting to retail somewhere in the spring unless they manage to increase their timeline. What impact will that have on consumers? What impact will that have on the industry itself? And then as a sideline to that, are there any privacy worries with that?
There is a lot of purchase of cannabis right now through online means as well as through dealers. We just don't know that activity because it's illegal, okay? And at this particular point, the governments, every provincial government has authority and responsibility to do online sales. But in this province, that will be the only way you're gonna get it because of the proactive and intelligent thing that Doug Ford did. I didn't vote for him, but what he decided to do in terms of, in terms of privatizing cannabis retail is the best way to ensure proper access to this product, to get rid of the illegal market. The challenge, though, is if we're going to make it only available online in this province, you are not going to get the largest consumers of cannabis to want to put their name into a government-run database and register for it. We have to be, I don't want to sound very preachy, but we have to be realistic and think like adults here. The biggest consumers of cannabis, according to the data, tend to be young people who are not going to put their names into a government database, order it, and then wait the 2 or 3 days for it to be delivered to their homes. So I think, as much as I'm very happy that the product will become legal on October 18th, I don't think online sales will make a significant dent. I think you need physical stores, and that will only come in the spring of next year. And you need a lot of physical stores. So online, I think, is a nice novelty. We think of the Amazon effect of a lot of different categories. I think when it comes to cannabis, it's not going to be successful. If you look at the LCBO data and how much liquor people buy online, it's less than 0.1% of the total liquor sales in this province.
The industry clearly thinks that there is going to be a big market for this, or they wouldn't be all in the way that they are. So I'm going to start with this question for you, Mitchell, and then move actually on to the health effects for you, if possible. We're trying to think about it generationally. So you mentioned that young people are the biggest consumers. What do we actually anticipate going forward in terms of all of them? It'd be actual kids, young adults, Gen X, seniors. What do we think the market is, sort of from Mitchell's perspective? And then moving over to you, what does that mean health-wise?
Most of the consumption, according to the data that I've seen, okay, and I'm not talking about self-reporting data to the government, because that's self-reported, but most of what I've seen, it's young people, 15 to 24, who are the largest users. And
absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, as you get older, that usage falls off. So the problem number one is that we want to tackle the black market and make it safe for kids, but the age of majority in this province is 19, and a big chunk of the consumption is for people younger than 19. So they won't be part of the legal market unless they get an older brother, sister, or parent to buy it for them. So that's problem number one. And they will do that because that's how I used to buy beer and alcohol all the time. So number two, the government is hoping, and a lot of licensed producers are hoping, that a lot of middle-aged people come into the category and forego beer and spirits and wine and move into the cannabis world. That is possible, but there's no data to show that that will be the case, number one. We're hoping it is, but there's no data to prove it. And number two, buying it once is not the same thing as becoming a repeatable customer. So coming back to the industry and these crazy valuations of the licensed producer and companies, my own sense is, and I don't own any of these stocks, and I'm not making any predictions on the stock market, so please don't take anything what I'm saying, precisely what I'm saying, but it's based on the best case scenarios. And those best case scenarios may come to pass. The critical question, and what us in business always talk about, is not if, but when. And when could be a long time, or could be within a year and a half. But I'd be betting a little bit longer than one year, 1.5 years.
Okay. So what we know now is this, totally agree with you. Young people use cannabis. When you look at all the data, and we in Canada are, number one, number two in the world. I think we're now dropped down to number two in the world for cannabis users. But we are way up there. We use more than most other nations do. And so when we look at our young people, depending on the age group that you're looking at, 20 to 24, it's 45% of the population that age uses cannabis. That's probably underreported. When we look at our teenagers, somewhere between 22%, but the grade 12s, it jumps up to 39%. And again, probably underestimated. What do I think is going to happen when it's legal? Probably not a whole lot with those age groups. They're using already. Those that want to use. They're not using because it's illegal, because they don't really care. There's more marijuana, weed, whatever you want to call it, in the high schools than we can get downtown Toronto in a dispensary. So if they want it, they're going to use it. So what we've seen in Colorado, if you actually look at the stats now, their usage is significantly higher than the national use in the U.S., but it's been that way for many, many years. So it's not like it's just jumped up recently. The young people, there was a little blip right when it was legal, when it was legalized, but really it's kind of come down now to where it was. So do I expect the same thing here? Yes. My concern as a parent and as a physician is that there is this sense of the government's legalizing it. So remember, in the states it's different, because it is federally illegal. By the states it's legal, but it's federally illegal. So there's still this overwhelming illegal substance talk going on there. But here we have a federal government that's legalizing it. And to a child and a teenager, that really means it must be fine. Why would they legalize it if it's not a problem? And so there's going to be, in my mind, and there is right now, I mean, to be honest, it started already, a sense of, well, it's no big deal. I hear it from people, employees, from my patients, from teenagers who I speak with. It is not a big deal. It's going to be legal. Who cares? It must be fine. So I actually think our stats here are going to look a little bit different than Colorado, but I still believe that the teenagers who are using now are probably going to keep using, maybe legally, maybe not. And you know, there may be a little bit more buy-in from other people because it's no big deal, especially when their parents are using. So that's, you know, so who do I think is going to actually be the users? More use is going to be adults. Adults who may not have tried it before because they, you know, didn't. And again, do I think they're going to start coming, you know, using every single day? You know, my 70-whatever old mother? No, I don't think so. But may somebody's mother decide to try it once because they're curious? Maybe. But, you know, that's the age group that we start to see where there's going to be an increase. And we see that in other jurisdictions where they've legalized it. So.
If I could just add one quick thought to that, it's when we're having this conversation about who will use, who won't, what will the numbers look like, we're always kind of treating cannabis as if it's one size fits all, and there's a wide array of cannabis products that are out there and are going to be available on the legal market, especially as we move into edibles and concentrates next year. And so I think if you kind of break it down by THC prominent products versus CBD prominent products, they are both equally regulated in the new, you know, in the Cannabis Act going forward. Even though CBD is non-psychoactive, it will be regulated just like THC is. And so I think it just will be interesting to look at the breaking down the types of products and who is using them. And I think we'll see some interesting trends with the demographics there, because, you know, I have parents who are entering their 70s and I'm, you know, the CBD products are all the rage amongst their group of friends, and everybody's using it to help them sleep and to help with their arthritic knees and to, you know, it's really, so I think it will be interesting to see how, who chooses to use what and how.
So the question I'm going to ask every single one of you is, in your view, so from your perspectives, from your professions, like where you sit, who wins and who loses after October 17th?
We all win. We, in my humble opinion, we all win, because if we can regulate a product right now, which, you know, and these folks can talk about it much better than I, that have, you know, various levels of health, you know, issues with it, that's a good thing. If we can generate any kind of tax revenue that's net positive for our community and our province and our country, that's a win. If we can grow up as a society and realize, you know, we can take responsibility and consume one of these products in a responsible way, we all win. So I'm very bullish, even though I'm not a smoker and a consumer. I think this is going to be by far a net positive thing for all of us.
I think we win as society, because I think we are, you know, not just from a tax revenue and, you know, job creation perspective and the economic benefits of it, but we are, you know, hopefully the loser is the illicit market, hopefully in particular the illicit market that is connected with organized crime. I mean, my only fear attached to that is if the revenues and the profits aren't there, that they turn their attention and their efforts to something that's perhaps much more harmful for us as a society. But, really, when you look at it and you step back and you think about the relative risks and harms of alcohol and tobacco and sugar and all sorts of things that we have no issues consuming on a daily basis, there really is no justification for criminalizing cannabis. And it's kind of, I think, in the not too distant future, we'll probably look back and we'll be like, I can't believe that was illegal for a century. So, there's going to be all sorts of little hiccups along the way, and, you know, we're not going to get it totally right, and it'll evolve over time, but we're moving in the right direction.
So from my medical perspective, because I do addiction medicine, I will tell you that those that win are going to be the people that, A, don't have to go to a dealer who sells other things to be able to get what they want. So that's not a bad thing. Also knowing what they're going to be getting. I think there's something to be said about quality. I know a whole number of people that have medical authorizations because they want to know the product that they're getting. They won't need that any longer. They can go into a store or order online, one day hopefully go into a store. As a mother, I do have concerns, truthfully. Do I think that my kids are all of a sudden going to start, you know, using any more likelihood than they would already? maybe not, but it's that whole, you know, no big deal. And that's what I see. What worries me truthfully is the driving and the safety, and I think that we need to put a whole lot more money and tax dollars into educating people, because when you speak to people that use cannabis right now, they do not think it's a big deal to drive. And it is a big deal. We know that. I don't know where the line is. I can tell you, you know, maybe how much you should drink and how long you have to wait. We don't know that with THC, which is a problem. So that to me is the biggest issue. I don't know if there's a loser there, but it's a big issue.
Live Mic is produced by the Toronto Public Library. Gregory McCormick is the executive producer. This episode is produced by Natalie Curtis, with technical production by Michelle DeMarco, communications support from Sumaya Ahmed and Mabel Ho, and live AV by Jennifer Casper and Mesfin Basisu. Music is by Gyrus Khan, and I'm George Panayotu. Thanks so much for listening.